Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Here in the Northern Rockies, dark winter months are outlasted in basements, dens, and nooks where kindred souls gather together to share intel, swap fly patterns, and relive the memories from seasons past. This gathering spot, known locally as the February Room, is the inspiration for this podcast. No matter the season, the door is always open to those with a fly fishing story to tell. Brought to you by CD Fishing USA, the North American distributor for composite development fly rods and accessories. 40 years of Kiwi ingenuity and graphite technology now available at cd-fishing.us or your local CD USA dealer. Follow us on Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook. And remember to go fishing. Here's your host, the Carnops, and this is the February Room.
They say that most anglers go through a progression. They start out hoping to catch one fish, then heaps of fish, then the biggest fish to the most difficult fish. And then, eventually, the mentality shifts to an appreciation of the experience as a whole, and the pursuit of fish takes a back seat. At this stage, efforts are directed towards education, conservation, and involvement with groups and organizations of like-minded folks. Casey Hackathorn, does this model describe your personal journey through fly fishing at all?
Yeah, I think that's true, although I still like to catch fish.
Fair enough.
I think midway through my career, I started thinking that I needed to be working on things that were important to me, so I started gravitating toward conservation.
And you are the Upper Clark Fork Program Manager for TU now. I know it's been a journey to get there. You were a guide. You were an angler. Can you share, or still are an angler, of course, but can you share one of your past adventures with us?
I was thinking about that this morning on my way into the office. And one adventure that came to mind was not related to trout, but I was stationed in San Antonio in the Air Force and had started to get into floating rivers. And my roommate and I decided to go try out the Devil's River in South Texas and set up some shuttles and kind of just dove into this 60-mile trip that ends up down in Amistad Reservoir on the Texas border country. Midway through the trip, we started hooking into some big yellow cats. Wasn't really a target. We were down there trying to do some bass fishing and sitting around camp at night, threw on some smallmouth guts after eating some bass around the fire, and started hooking into some catfish that you had to lift off the ground to get their, or, you know, lift their gills above your waist to get the tails off the ground.
Nice.
And we weren't super well provisioned. We hadn't really done many river trips before, and somewhere along the way, I lost my rod into the river. I kicked over my last glass of whiskey, and that was kind of the end of the fishing for me. For
heartbreaking. Yeah. The rod's one thing, but the ladder's irreplaceable.
That was kind of the beginnings of my adventures on river trips that has led me to Montana and this whole career.
So that trip down the Devils was kind of the impetus for your move, move out to the West. You're from the Midwest originally, right? A Midwestern transplant?
Yeah, I grew up in around Kansas City. We lived on a farm and had a stream that ran through our farm. And yeah, I've always been fascinated by moving water. We were a family of meat fishermen, mostly lakes and reservoirs, and didn't really know much about rivers or how to navigate them. But that, you know, that kind of stuck with me all my life, and you know, eventually found my way to getting down them.
That's interesting that you kind of started out on the Devil's River. That's a place that I've been meaning to get to. I produced a show there years ago, but I was not able to attend the production. It looks just super cool. There's a bunch of different fish in that thing, correct?
Yeah, it's pretty neat. It basically flows out of the ground on the edge of the Edwards Plateau, which is the hill country in Texas. And the groundwater basically kind of finds its way out of this limestone system. So it flows out of the ground, swimming pool color, clear. And winds its way south through a bunch of ranch land before it hits Amistad Reservoir and meets up with the Pecos on the Rio Grande. But there's native bass. There's some chitlids, the Rio Grande perch in there. There's carp. There's several catfish. You know, it's kind of a menagerie of fish. No trout though.
That's okay. There's lots of places to fish for trout. It's cool when you can find a place like that with a variety of different warm water species to go target.
Yeah, at the time, it was not a place that there was much traffic. The stream access law in Texas is a little murkier than Montana. The ranchers down there date back to Spanish land grant time, so they own the bed of the river and the banks. And if you're not seen, is probably the best approach there, but it makes it a little harder to do multi-day trips. There's very little public land down there, so it's a little sporty, but a fun adventure.
So if you spill your bourbon down there, you're kind of out of luck. There's no recovering it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, in fact, the later trip is a whole other story. We'll talk some other time. But I lost a boat down there, and it's not very easy to get out of either.
The Devil's River's living up to its name for you.
Right.
Well, very cool. As I mentioned, you're the Upper Clark Fork Program Manager for TU. And one of our first introductions in person was on the Upper Clark Fork during a production of TU's television program with an emphasis on the cleanup efforts that were underway. And that was kind of right at the beginning of that cleanup effort, I believe. And for many years, the fishing improved greatly up there. And specifically, personally, I saw an increase in the numbers of West Slope cutthroat, which seemed to be making quite a comeback. Can you give us some background on the targeted habitat improvement projects on the Upper Clark Fork and the tributaries?
Yeah, I guess I might take a little step back and kind of just explain what's generally going on in the Upper Clark Fork. It's actually in the footprint of the largest geographic complex of Superfund sites in the country. It starts in Butte in the headwaters of the Clark Fork. Silverbow Creek runs through Butte, and there's a fair amount of mining activity dating back to the 1870s. And in 1908, there was a historic flood of record. At the time, there were more than a dozen smelters and tons of underground mines and butte. All of that smelter and mine waste got washed down into the Clark Fork, deposited in the floodplain through the Deer Lodge Valley, and then eventually stacked up behind the recently completed Milltown Dam. So those mine wastes contain a handful of metals and arsenic that are toxic to fish and people. And eventually they were designated as Superfund sites, and work began really in the mid-2000s to start cleaning them up. You were around through the whole Milltown Dam removal process that was pretty much completed by the time you and I did that float for the TU TV show. And I started working for Chud Unlimited about the time that the cleanup work turned toward that Deer Lodge Valley, kind of between Warm Springs, where the Clark Forks formed with Warm Springs Creek and Silverbow Creek, down to about Garrison. Those 43 miles is where the work on the Clark Fork's going on now to kind of restore that main stem river. And while that's going on, TU and numerous other partners are working on restoring and reconnecting the tributary habitat, so that by the time all that cleanup work's done, we hope to have a restored fishery, which the Clark Fork fishery itself is quite a fit far behind other major rivers around here, around 200 fish per mile on average. That kind of goes up and down, but that's about 20% of what it should be compared to, you know, the Blackfoot or the Bitterroot.
So looking at the Clark Fork as a whole, that's from basically like, you know, St. Regis or the confluence with the Flathead all the way up to Warm Springs, the average is about 200 fish per river mile.
No, that's just the upper Clark Fork. So essentially, okay, gotcha. Yeah, from it's through the areas that were most impacted by mining, essentially from its headwaters down to about Rock Creek. After Rock Creek, it's relatively normal.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
And so I've noticed a decline, just, I don't know if it's a decline in the fishing, just the last couple of times that I've floated up there, it hasn't been as good in the last year and a half as it was before. Mm-hmm. And, you know, initially I thought that, perhaps I was just running into bad timing, cause the river didn't look really any different to me. There just didn't seem to be trout where there usually are. And then I had heard a rumor of a fish kill and, you know, some incidental loss of fish habitat associated with some cleanup efforts. Can you kind of sift through the hyperbole and rhetoric here and provide us with your assessment of the trend relative to the Upper Clark Fork?
Yeah, I'll try to. I think that there's a lot more questions at this point than there are easy to sum up answers. One of the things to understand is that in addition to all those mining impacts, the Upper Clark Fork also suffers from all of the challenges that you see in other area rivers, from dewatering, the impacts of nutrients and, from both natural sources and from things like septic tanks and municipal water systems. So you have that those algae issues you see in the Clark Fork. And connectivity issues. So, their connected tributaries are also an issue. So you start stacking all of those problems on top of each other. Sometimes it's very hard to tease out what the actual limiting factors are for fish. But one part is undeniable, that in the last several years, the fishery immediately below Warm Springs Ponds, which is essentially where Silverbow Creek comes in and forms the Clark Fork, the fish populations drop precipitously. We're at kind of all-time lows in that reach immediately below the ponds. And historically, those ponds have been a subsidy for fish. Basically, it's not exactly a tailwater, but because of the nutrients available, it basically had a very productive system immediately below the ponds, with fish populations, you know, up to, you know, 2,000 fish per mile. Mostly brown trout dominated. Brown trout are a little more tolerant of higher water temperatures and the metals that were around up there. But most recent the last couple of years, the fish counts have been down, you know, below 100 in some cases, you know, less than 50 trout per mile in that reach.
Well, if you, as you mentioned, that fishery, the Upper Clark Fork, sits at the kind of epicenter of one of the country's largest Superfund sites. So it's a daunting task that you, TU, and your partners have to try to clean up an area that was so impacted by mining and other activities.
I've been at it for about 10 years, and I feel like I'm just kind of wrapping my arms around really what all is going on. China Unlimited is one of many partners, state and federal agencies, local advocates, all kind of working toward that same goal. So there's dozens of people out there spending their careers trying to work on this. And, you know, we just have kind of one piece of the puzzle. But I guess I didn't probably quite answer your question. So the last 10 years or so, the state has started to do remediation, restoration work on that upper river. About 10 miles of the 43 or so has been completed. And some folks are pointing toward that as like the reason that the fish population has dropped. And there's quite a bit of research right now trying to understand, you know, what the habitat impacts of this, you know, of this cleanup work is having, and trying to figure out whether, if the habitat's limiting, what can be done while in the process of that cleanup work to help kind of nudge things along. Personally, I don't think that's the sole problem. And certainly it's an important piece, and, you know, we're hoping to see some more faster recovery from that work. But there's other things going on, I think, that we need to get a handle on before that fishery is going to fully recover.
Yeah. So the big takeaway is that, you know, this is, it's a massive watershed for one, the Clark Fork being the largest watershed by volume in the state of Montana, mm-hmm. correct?
That's true. Yeah. And the Upper Clark Fork, the parts that are essentially above Milltown Dam or above the Blackfoot River, about 4,000 square miles. So it's a big area.
And a big area that was mistreated in terms of cold water habitat for many decades.
Yeah.
And it's going to take a lot of time and effort to get this to where your aspirations are and to you and your partners and you know, maybe where some of the local angling community would like it to be.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. So you got to kind of ride these little fluctuations in and out, because I know that, you know, it seemed like 4 years ago, it was really good up there. And then of course you have more angling pressure too. And, you know, to kind of steer things away from the Upper Clark Fork, specifically, Western Montana as a whole kind of stands at a crossroads. You know, on one fork, we have really largely healthy river systems here. And, you know, we're on the heels of several good water years. So we're enjoying the benefits of that, of having plenty of cold, clear water in the systems on our side of the mountains anyway. And on the other road, we have this legion of anglers and mm-hmm. increased commercial use guides and other river users that shows no signs of slowing down. In your opinion, how do we find some measure of balance to maintain the river resources, the fish, and the overall experience for river users?
Well, that is a really good question, Justin.
Dude, it's $1 million question.
at this point spend my time trying to solve the things that I know that I can fix over time, essentially trying to figure out how to make conservation work for the communities of people living on the landscape with ranchers and water users. And but the whole challenge that we're facing now with the influx of more people is something I don't know how we're going to approach. The increase in recreation out there is, you know, it's visible pretty much every time you hit the river. And we just need to try to sort out how not to love it to death and we've enjoyed so much, I mean, freedom really in Montana for decades, to be able to find solitude by just going a little farther than everybody else. And that's, you know, that's just no, that's not the case anymore. So I'm hopeful that, you know, this next generation of folks behind us can solve some of those challenges.
There you go. Passing the buck again. Oh, it's a daunting question, and there's no easy answer. It's kind of like I liken it to looking up at the stars.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, it's so overwhelming, and I think everybody is concerned about it. Yet there's no, you know, nobody has any clear answers whether some sort of increased permitting system is in order, some sort of, you know, allocation, in terms of guide days for individual outfitters. Mm-hmm. It's not, obviously we're not pointing the finger at guides and outfitters. They're part of the overall, consumption of the river, but, the increase in just, you know, overall use, I think we're at a point where it needs to be addressed, but, I don't know what the answer is to that, obviously.
There's been a lot of people taking a lot of different stabs at it. I mean, the Blackfoot's been reviewed, I think, three times since I've dating back to the early 2000s, and no one's ever really come up with an answer there. You know, there's some rules that got implemented on the Big Hole and the Beaverhead around the same time, that address commercial use. The West Fork Bitterroot went through a similar process, and now kind of the Madison's the hot point in the state for that issue. And there really hasn't been a model that gets at all of it. You know, it's the easiest thing to do is to point to the commercial users, and that's certainly a big piece of the puzzle. But it's also not, it doesn't encompass all of the challenge we're facing now. I think, you know, you go down to go try to buy a raft right now. Everything's sold out. I think the pandemic, basically people decided that they were going to spend their money on things they wanted to do. And there's a whole influx of new users out there. But I think you're right. The time is now, and I don't know how to fix it, but waiting isn't a very good answer.
Yeah, it's such an interesting consequence of the pandemic. I don't know if consequence is the right word, but I did not foresee this surge in outdoor activity as a tag along aspect of a global pandemic.
Right.
Yeah. I think it caught everybody off guard. Those that maybe foresaw it probably have been able to capitalize on it to some degree, it was crazy because, you know, when it first hit in 2020, I thought, oh man, this is going to be awesome. Like, nobody's going to be able to get here. We're going to have these rivers to ourselves. Nobody was at work, and all of the locals, even though, you know, the folks obviously from surrounding states, felt comfortable traveling here, but just the amount of local fishing pressure that showed up, which was a kind of a cool thing to see. Initially, you know, families out together on the river, that's kind of how it's supposed to be. But then, as things kind of opened up, and then that mentality shifted to where, oh, I need to start enjoying life. I need to get outside. This is the safest place for me and my family, is to go camping and go on the river. And then that all just kind of collided. And we ended up with, you probably know the actual user numbers. I don't, but just, you know, from observation, I'd never seen anything like it here.
Right. Yeah, I don't know about the numbers from last year, but it's been on a steady increase already, and it seems pretty obvious that is that curve is steepened considerably. All of a sudden, I think that one of the challenges facing is just educating a whole new group of users out there on, I don't know, the rules of the road. Try to go to a boat ramp on a busy day right now, and you just I think it kind of sets people off a little bit because, but it's largely just ignorance. I mean, no, everybody was there at some point, didn't know how to do it, but I don't know how you go about like teaching people how to be considerate of others.
Right. Right. And that, you know, increased use is going to lead to conflicts, is going to lead to, there's an inevitable, negative connotation that's going to arise from this and be directed towards commercial use in particular. And, you know, some of those folks that maybe don't know the rules of the road. And that's something that we need to really try to avoid because that ruins the overall river experience for everybody. I've seen that occur in other places, as I'm sure you have as well. So that's the kind of the possible outcome here that is of concern to a lot of us for sure. Like, you know, for instance, last year on the Upper Bitterroot, I had a local guy up there with his wife and, you know, granted the dude's been drinking. But he was really aggressive towards myself, towards other river users. And, you know, initially I was like, man, what a jack wagon.
Right.
But then as I thought about it, I'm like, well, you know, here's a guy that's probably lived up in Darby his whole life. And, he's seen this scene play out where his enjoyment of the river has been completely compromised, by all this use and activity. And he's just totally disgruntled about it. And, you know, is fed up. And I don't blame him for that. Right. And that is a concern to all of us, you know, like we don't want to get to a point where we don't go take our kids fishing because there's just going to be 10 guide boats at the boat ramp and a bunch of other folks. And, you know, what's the fun of going outside to escape stuff if there's nothing you can escape from?
Right. Right. So, I guess for those of us in the conservation community, we're hopeful that increasing the number of people that are invested in, that turns those people toward investing in conservation, or hopefully there's, a responding groundswell and need to conserve.
Right, which is hopefully a positive outcome. In all of this is that, as more people do get involved in fishing and boating and river recreating, then you have a larger base of concerned citizens that mm-hmm. then want to perhaps follow this initial progression that I mentioned and, you know, land at a place where they're like, okay, well, we do need to do something to preserve and protect mm-hmm. this for mm-hmm. future generations. You've spent a lot of time recreating in Montana, fishing, hunting, hiking. Any close calls with bears or other wildlife you got?
I personally have not been threatened by any predators. All of my encounters with bears have resulted in them running away, which I'm thankful for, but grizzlies are definitely on the move out there. And a lot of the places that I'm used to hunting without fear of those kind of encounters is, I guess that area is diminishing pretty rapidly.
Right.
So it's always on my mind.
Are there places that you don't go anymore? Due to the potential, you know, the chances of running into a bear?
I think that during archery season, I guess when we're a little more susceptible to those kind of encounters, I've started to just kind of shy away from some of the areas closer to the park. I've been hearing, you know, more and more reports of them moving into the big hole, which gives me pause, but hasn't kept me away.
Gotcha. Yeah, there's places that I don't hunt anymore because I've seen enough bears up there, you know, specifically like the area around Lincoln. Like you, I haven't had any close calls like where I felt that I was in danger. I've been close to bears, but fortunately they've gone their other way and I've gone mine. But there's definitely, it's always on my mind and there are places that I don't go anymore.
Yeah. It's interesting. The Blackfoot people had some encounters from boats up there.
Yeah.
Having some false charges coming out of raft, and you never really think, you know, you're always kind of thinking about it when you're hiking, but, and then Matthew Churchman, who, got attacked last year on a river trip, over on the front, makes you kind of start thinking about having that bear spray in your boat in some of those places.
Yeah, for sure. You know, we had done that same float where Matt got attacked a week before, and it could have easily been us. You know, I can't say that I had the bear spray on my hip all the time. And I'm sure knowing that crew and those anglers and and those boaters, you know, I know that they were very well prepared, and it was just one moment where the guard was let down, and that can happen to anyone. I just got a new bear spray belt. Have you seen those?
No, it sounds good though.
So it's neat. It's like a little fanny pack, and it's neon. It looks great on rollerblades.
You always struggle with trying, you know, I attach it to my pack, but then it's usually stuck and then you can't take it off, and or you set your pack down and you're making a stalk or something. It's kind of hard to figure out what to do with it. And then you're always afraid that you're actually going to set it off when it's in your rig. I haven't had that happen yet. But it doesn't sound like it's would be very pleasant.
Did I ever tell you my bear spray, myself bear spraying incident?
I don't think so.
So, I was bow hunting. This was probably 15 years ago up by Lincoln. And, my buddies and I had stayed out a little late that evening, and we were jamming to get back to the truck. And we went through this stand of like kind of old burned out lodgepole Christmas trees. And you know how those are super grabby and sticky. Mm-hmm. And at some point during that descent, unbeknownst to me, one of those Christmas trees grabbed the safety latch on my bear spray. And I didn't know that. And then when I got down to the truck, we were parked below this little embankment, and I had to step down, and I pinned the bear spray between my belly, my gut, and my upper thigh, and the nozzle went down my pants, and I emptied about half the can down my pants. So don't bear spray your own balls. That's the moral of the story.
Have you recovered from that?
I did. It took some time. I rushed down to camp and I took a shower, and I might have had a nip of Bushmills. And I laid down on my cot and everything seemed okay. And then, you know, 20 minutes later, it started burning and I didn't sleep a wink that night. And about 4 in the morning, it kind of started to subside. And I thought, oh, I'm good enough to go hunt today. So we went back up on the mountain, and when I started hiking, you know, I assumed my sweat pores opened back up, and it all started over again. And I was sitting there, we were glassing some elk. I put my binos up and I took them down, and I felt my eyes kind of burning. And I looked at my buddy and he started laughing at me. And he's like, man, let's get the hell out of here. You're a mess. You've got bear sprays in your eye. You got bear spray in your eyes. I can smell it all over you. It's starting to sting me. This is a done deal. And, yeah, I had to end up throwing my clothes away. I tried washing it out of them, but that capsaicin's sticky stuff.
Yeah.
So anyway, you do bring up a good point. I've got to spend some time on the Blackfoot here in the next little bit, and I'm going to get a new can today to go with my new belt, because I did hear one of those stories that you related of a boat being bluff charged up there recently.
Mm-hmm.
Well, good. Any other fishing stories or anything that you got for us today, Casey? You got you must have you ever flip a boat or lose an oar or anything interesting, or are you just a straight shooter?
Well, I think that they say that there's only two kinds of people that flipped a boat and people that haven't flipped a boat yet.
Right. Which class are you?
I flip some boats. Yeah. This non-fishing story, but I don't know, must have been 15 or 20 years ago. I was sitting at one of those houses on Vine Street in the Lower Rattlesnake, and had a few cocktails, and started talking to a longtime friend of mine, but I'd never met him before, about paddling. I had taught some canoe courses for Knowles over the years, and we started trading stories about canoe trips, and he said, "Well, you know, the North Fork of the Blackfoot's looking pretty good right now. Would you want to go paddle with me tomorrow in a tandem canoe?" And for those of you that have spent time whitewater paddling, when you get in a boat with another person, there's a lot of dynamics, you know, and they call it a divorce boat for a reason. But you know, the guy seemed pretty competent. Well, he's a close friend now, but neither one of us had paddled with each other before, and jumped on. Long story short, we jumped on the North Fork at about 3,000 CFS, and didn't really make it more than a couple hundred yards before we swamped and flipped, and had kind of a bad swim trying to keep up with the boat, bashed my knee, had to run up to the road and start chasing the boat down. Eventually, a kayaker pushed it over to the side. I had to swim back across the river, plugged a hole that had been punched through the hull of the boat, and like about the size of your finger, like a hot poker went through the whole thing. I don't know what it was that did it, but I'm glad it wasn't through my rib cage.
Jeez.
And we got the boat out, got it back on the car, and basically turned around and went home.
What'd you plug the hole with?
Just duct tape, you know.
Oh, temporary. There you go.
Yeah. Yeah, it was Chuck's boat, and yeah, we actually haven't been. We're longtime friends at this point. We haven't been back in a boat together since.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
that was the end of the romance.
I guess the moral of the story is, you know, to start with something mellow when you're learning a new partner.
Yeah, that's good advice. I tend to veer towards the more mellow stuff anyway when I can these days. But yeah, around here you can get in trouble just about anywhere. You gotta kind of be on your toes, especially this time of year when we're just on the heels of runoff and everything's changed and there's new trees in the water and everybody's out fishing. So
yeah,
if folks want to learn more about TU and the efforts on the Upper Clark Fork, what's the best way for them to find that information?
They can look on TU.org, or they can just give me a call.
You're at kc.hackathorn@tu.org, is that right?
That's correct.
Go to thefebruaryroom.com, where you can access a complete library of our podcast and read more about our guests, their fishing stories, and favorite fly patterns. We're always looking for exceptional fly fishing yarns, and if you have one to spend, shoot us an email at info@thefebruaryroom.com. The February Room is always free, but if you feel like throwing a nickel in the pond, we appreciate any additional listener support. For companies and individuals interested in sponsorship opportunities, please contact us for our media kit. Thanks for stopping by the February Room, and we'll see you down here next week.